Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Abella. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program, the Cancer Connect Education Workshop, which is being done in partnership with Longevity Foundation. And today's program is supported by Regeneron, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and supported by a grant from Genentech. I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, I want to say a few things about the participants on today's program. We have over 325 participants on this program today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Germany, Namibia, Nigeria, the Philippines, Tanzania, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. So now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Joshua Sabari. And Dr. Sabari is attending physician, thoracic medical oncology, assistant professor of medicine, NYU Langone Health, Perlmutter Cancer Center. And Dr. Sabari will be addressing an overview of non-small cell lung cancer, including current standard of care, and the role of chemotherapy and targeted cancer therapies. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sabari.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I want to thank you for the invitation, and as well as Cancer Care Connect. And thank you to Longevity Foundation for hosting and sort of sponsoring working with this event. So, you know, lung cancer is quite common. You know, globally, it's the number one cause of cancer. And in the United States, lung cancer is the second most common cause of cancer. And it's important to understand that there are different types of lung cancer. When we think about lung cancer, you know, we often think about, you know, non-small cell versus small cell lung cancer. I'll really focus on non-small cell this afternoon. This makes up about 85% of the lung cancers diagnosed in the United States. And when we think about non-small cell lung cancer, it's important to understand two key features. The first one is, where did the cancer start? And where is the cancer gone in the body? We call that the stage of the cancer. So if a cancer started in the lung and stays in the lung and hasn't learned to travel elsewhere in the body, we would call that an early stage lung cancer. And, you know, that would be resected with surgery alone, and the rates of cure are quite high. Now, in a cancer that starts in the lung and learns to travel through the blood to other places in the body, like the bone, for example, or the liver, we would refer to that as a stage 4 cancer. And we know that stage 4 cancers are treatable, but they're not curable in 2025. That being said, there have been many advances in sort of thinking about how we can allow people to live longer and live better, even with a stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis. So very important, anytime someone is diagnosed, we understand the stage. Lots of advances in technology in us better understanding, like imaging, CT scans, PET scans, MRIs, in order to understand the stage. And then more recently, using bronchoscopy as well as navigational bronchoscopic approaches to better understand where the cancer is in the body. Now, we'll focus the discussion today on stage 4 cancer, and we'll really talk about the roles of, you know, systemic therapy. Now, what is a systemic therapy? In sort of simple terms, a systemic therapy is a therapy that goes all throughout the body and treats cancer, not just in the lung, but in any area that the cancer could have spread or metastasized to, like the liver, for example, or the bone. And one thing, you know, folks often don't, you know, sort of think about is that a cancer cell in the lung may be the same as the cancer cell in the liver, meaning they have the same biology. There may be some, you know, slight differences in the genetics and sort of the makeup, but with a treatment that works on the lung lesion, it should also have activity in that area in the liver. So what kinds of systemic therapies do we talk about? Well, we talk about chemotherapy, and that's really a conventional cytotoxic therapy. We also talk about immunotherapy. Immunotherapies rev up the immune system to better recognize and attack cancer. And then more recently, we talk a lot about targeted therapies. And you'll hear from Dr. Brea about advances in the EGFR space, one of the more common mutations that we identify in lung cancer. So very important that you understand the stage of the cancer, and then also very important to understand what biomarkers are there. And biomarkers are a complex terminology, and we'll hear a lot more about the role of biomarkers. But, you know, if you are a loved one of a family member or you are a patient who is newly diagnosed with lung cancer, it is critical that you ask your team, your clinician, the nurse who's caring for you, what are my biomarkers? Because your biomarkers will help us then select the best possible therapy, the best possible systemic therapy. So, for example, if somebody has a specific biomarker, a mutation in an EGFR gene, for example, or a MET gene, we may think about using specific targeted therapies, typically pills, small molecules that could be utilized to treat that cancer. And we know that it will shrink the disease and allow people to live well with good quality of life and hopefully extend life. There are also immunotherapeutics that could be utilized. Immunotherapy revs up the immune system. Interestingly, it doesn't attack or kill cancer, but allows your own immune system to recognize and attack cancer. And with that, we really look at the PD-L1 expression. That's a marker on the surface of cancer cells that helps us better understand the likelihood of immunotherapy working. We'll hear more from Dr. Brea about the importance of molecular testing in order to help differentiate using targeted therapies from immunotherapy. And then lastly, chemotherapy has remained a standard of care, but as our therapies improve and as outcomes improve for patients, we are seeing less utilization of chemotherapy in the frontline setting, but still remains a standard of care for some patients, and really talk to your team about why you're getting what systemic therapy you're receiving. So with that, I want to hand it back to Dr. Carol Messner to continue on with the program. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sabari. That was just a superb presentation, stellar, and you are the first speaker, so you really set the tone for today's program. So thank you so much, and I look forward during the Q&A for there being questions for you as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Elliot Joseph Brea, and Dr. Brea is physician, Loewe Center for Thoracic Oncology, Department of Medicine, Medical Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Brea will be addressing new treatment approaches and how clinical trials contribute to treatment options and the role of biomarkers and precision medicine in informing treatment choices. It is my great pleasure to turn this over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Brea.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, Dr. Sabari, as well as the participants joining in on this call. You know, it's really an exciting time to be a thoracic oncologist. We've seen a dramatic amount of new therapies and clinical trials in the lung cancer space. And, you know, as we heard, some of these advances we've seen are in what we call oncogenic drivers like EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. This is one of the most common mutations we see in patients that either are have a light tobacco history or have never used tobacco products. And, you know, I think this has been exciting because we've seen a lot of recent data that we can use combination strategies either with using targeted therapies such as pills like osimertinib with chemotherapy or potentially chemotherapy-free approaches where we use targeted therapy called lazertinib in combination with an infusional drug called amivantamab. And both these approaches, you know, have really helped patients to live much longer with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And so, you know, that's really been a dramatic advance that we've seen now with these two regimens in the last year. As well as, you know, other therapies for patients after they may progress on EGFR inhibitors. And so, you know, we've seen an FDA approval of an antibody-drug conjugate. I like to think of this as similar to how we use chemotherapy often for our patients with lung cancer. Antibody-drug conjugates are like heat-seeker missiles and go after specific targets on the cancer cell. And this, you know, one particular drug called datopotamab deruxtecan, was recently approved for previously treated EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And so that's been an exciting option to have for our patients, as well as, you know, other potential options. Dr. Savary also mentioned MET. You know, we had previously known MET as an oncogenic driver, you know, one of the eight oncogenic drivers. What has emerged recently is we now had recent approval for another antibody-drug conjugate called telisotuzumab vedotin, based on patients that have non-squamous EGFR wild-type non-small cell lung cancer that's MET positive, which, you know, the biomarker, again, is defined as MET3 plus greater than 50%. And, you know, that can potentially allow for a lot more patients, you know, that may not have had a MET mutation to be treated if they have high levels of this MET protein. So, you know, what I'm getting at is we're increasingly seeing that our therapies for non-small cell lung cancer are, you know, being more personalized and tailored. And I think one of the things to, you know, talk with your oncologist, and I think, you know, we as a community have gotten much better at this, is really doing, you know, upfront biomarker testing. The way I like to describe biomarkers to my patients is that cancer cells acquire things like genetic mutations or alterations in genes that help drive the cancer. And we want to identify these because we could potentially, you know, pair these with specific treatments, you know, either in the form of pills or in some cases things like, you know, infusional drugs, systemic therapies that we give by IV. And then other changes such as these cell surface markers, you know, we've known about PD-L1 as a biomarker for immunotherapy, but now with HER2 and MET, you know, and potentially others, we may be able to more precisely pair patients with therapies that we think are going to be more effective and also have less side effects. And so I often tell patients we look for these mutations. It's similar to like doing the diagnostic workup when you take your car to a mechanic. We want to try to pinpoint these specific changes that we can go after it, you know, with a targeted approach with pill or other systemic therapies that are highly effective. But most importantly, we're seeing that these minimize side effects compared to what we had previously been using. You know, I think it's really been a dramatic change if you look at the number of new approvals for thoracic cancer, such as non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer, that we have compared to, you know, what we had even a few years ago. Now, turning to the importance of clinical trials, you know, I'm fortunate, as are others on this call, to really participate in a number of clinical trials, which we often, you know, offer for our patients, either, you know, in the first line or, you know, potentially when standard treatment stopped working, to really try to improve upon, you know, what we have currently in our portfolio of FDA-approved treatments. And I always like to talk with my patients and offer trials. And, it's often, you know, we talk about it being a good fit, you know, a trial that we're not only excited about, but that a patient, you know, is able to manage logistics. You know, one of the things with clinical trials is they do require, you know, more frequent visits and potentially other testing that is a little bit more in addition to what a standard treatment would. You know, and some of us do treat patients that come from a distance. So I often like to encourage people to, you know, consider a clinical trial, and if it might not be the right fit and there's a good standard treatment, we can always keep clinical trials in our back pocket. You know, we often are seeing a lot more of our, you know, clinical trials also being enrolled in community oncology practices across the country, which I think is great that, you know, patients don't always have to travel, you know, to major academic cancer centers to get their treatment. Or, you know, we work in collaboration with a local oncologist to say, you know, maybe we have a good option now, but down the line to keep a clinical trial in mind. And so, you know, I think this is a partnership that we, you know, continue to work with oncologists across the country with clinical trials as well as our patients to really try to, you know, get the best treatment that the patient is going to tolerate the best. And with that, I'd like to hand it off to my colleague, Biagio Ricciuti, who can talk a little bit more about some of the side effects and how we're trying to improve upon this.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bria. That was just, again, a stellar, superb, and very comprehensive presentation. I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Biagio Ricciuti. And Dr. Ricciuti is thoracic medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Department of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ricciuti will be addressing new ways to manage treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort and pain, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ricciuti.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction, and hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about some of the new treatments we're using for lung cancer, but also the new kinds of side effects we are seeing and how we're improving the way we manage symptoms, comfort, and ultimately try to improve overall quality of life for our patients. Over the last few years that we have heard in the prior two presentations, lung cancer therapy has really changed. Beyond the immune checkpoint inhibitors that many of you may already know, such as those agents targeting PD-1 or PD-L1, that Dr. Brea and somebody have reviewed already, we now have a new spectrum of immunotherapies, some of which are called T-cell engagers, which basically bring the immune cells directly in close contact to tumor cells to enable recognition and killing of those cancer cells. One of these most promising examples is called tarlatamab, which can be used today for patients with small cell lung cancer. And because the immune system can start a strong immune reaction against the cancer, during the early doses, for example, we now have our patients staying in the hospital where we can really closely monitor for, you know, fever, low blood pressure, breathing changes. And to minimize these reactions, for example, we use now premedication, including steroids, fluids, or anti-inflammatory drugs. And once the first few doses are tolerated, then treatment can be continued safely in the outpatient setting. This is just one example of new treatments and new therapeutics that have shown very promising efficacy in patients with small cell lung cancer, for example, which has traditionally been a type of lung cancers where we had limited treatment options. But of course, with innovation, oftentimes comes new toxicities. And we have another example of how transformative therapeutics are bringing us a new spectrum of side effects, which we need to learn how to manage. Specifically, I'm referring to a class of medicines called antibody drug conjugates. And I think Dr. Brea has already reviewed one example of these ADCs. These are medications that act like guided missiles, delivering chemotherapy directly to cancer cells while trying to spare most of healthy tissues. There are also additional therapeutics called bispecific antibodies, and one example is called amivantamab, which can be used to treat patients with specific mutations in the EGFR genes. But again, as I mentioned, with innovation come a new class of side effects. And so I'd like to start by speaking briefly about antibody drug conjugates, because one of the concerns we have with these medications, which we're really not used to deal with, at least as thoracic oncologists, is an inflammation of the lung or pneumonitis. This is very important. We need to catch this early, which is why we are now encouraging patients to report minimal changes in their breathing status, for example. We're also encouraging patients to use wearable devices such as home pulse oximeters that they can use in their houses, and this allows us to monitor for oxygen levels and allows us to act quickly in case any drop is seen. Some of these new antibody drug conjugates can also cause additional side effects such as mouth sores or mucositis, eye irritation, and potentially also cardiac effects. So as we start to learn how to use these medicines in thoracic oncology, we now recommend regular dental ophthalmology visits, and we're engaging with different professionals that are helping us recognize and possibly prevent some of these side effects, because as I mentioned, early identification is key. For the amivantamab, for example, this new medication we are currently using to treat patients with specific EGFR mutations in different settings, while we've seen a very promising efficacy and durable responses, which has been certainly very exciting for us as providers and for our patients, we're also dealing with severe skin reactions. And preventions, we're learning, makes a major difference. Patients are now beginning a proactive skincare routine before treatment even starts. So that's something we didn't really do before, but now that we've learned how to deal with this toxicity, we are recommending, for example, using daily topical steroids, topical antibiotics, oral antibiotics. All of these are now reducing the risk of skin toxicity for this medication. This is just one example. Another area of interest is now delivering this medication not as intravenous infusion, but maybe as subcutaneous infusions. We do know, for example, that this medication I just mentioned, the amivantamab, which are increasingly using for patients with EGFR mutation, is currently delivered as intravenous medication. And this is associated with a very high risk of infusion reaction, especially during the first two doses. And so now there are data showing that if we can deliver this medication subcutaneously, and we're really hoping to have this formulation available in the U.S. Soon, we can really decrease the risk of infusion reaction and ultimately improve patient comfort as they start a new treatment. Another key strategy across all these treatments is actually dose modification. temporarily lowering or pausing a dose does not necessarily mean that the therapy is failing or is not working anymore. It actually allows the body to recover, allow patients to safely continue treatment, potentially. And this individualized approach, for example, adjusting the dose, the timing, potentially, or use of supportive, proactive medication, really helps preserve both treatment efficacy and ultimately quality of life for our patients. And I would like also to emphasize that nutrition is part today of comprehensive care. You know, eating well supports strength, healing, and tolerance to treatments. Usually, you know, small, frequent meals, rich in proteins, adequate hydration, and also guidance from oncology dietitians, for example. We work closely with them for many of our patients. It can really help reduce the fatigue, help maintain weight, and ultimately improve energy. At the same time, we also work closely with supportive and palliative care team from the very beginning. This is not something we should consider for patients who have exhausted their treatment options or are approaching the late line of therapies. We actually are starting to engage with palliative care early on, but also for patients with early stage lung cancer. They can help managing pain, fatigue, neuropathy, side effects, appetite changes, sleep issues, and ultimately also emotional health. And this ensures that patients feel as well as possible throughout the therapy, no matter the stage of the treatment. And perhaps most importantly, communication is key. Whenever patients note new symptoms, as mild as they can be, they should really reach out to their oncology team, whether this implies shortness of breath, skin rash, high irritation, changes in appetite, and sometimes changes in mood. They can mask something bigger. And so early reporting allows us to intervene promptly, prevent complication, and help patients stay on therapy longer and more comfortably. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Dr. Kudi, that was just a superb presentation, stellar in every way, and you covered a lot of really important issues for our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Rosenzweig, and Dr. Rosenzweig is Professor and Chair, Department of Radiation Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, System Chair, Mount Sinai Health System. And Dr. Rosenzweig will be addressing the role of the radiation oncologist, the importance of radiation treatments in managing non-small cell lung cancer and cancer pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rosenzweig.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Messner, for that introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm a radiation oncologist, and we use radiation to treat cancer, and especially lung cancer. So radiation has a role in treating all stages of lung cancer. So we've talked a little bit today about early stage lung cancer. So that's a situation where the tumor is in the lung but has not spread to any lymph nodes or any sites outside of the lung. And this is the most curable stage of lung cancer. And as mentioned earlier, the standard of care is to do surgery on these tumors and cut them out, and that is curative. But a lot of people are unable to have surgery due to other medical problems, a reluctance to undergo a surgical procedure, or the location of the tumor. So in these situations, the radiation takes the place of the surgery, and we do very focused radiation called stereotactic body radiation therapy. And that's just 3, 4, or 5 treatments, very focused on the tumor, all done as an outpatient. Each treatment takes about 30 minutes or so, and people go home afterwards, and just those couple of treatments can completely cure an early stage lung cancer. This treatment's been around for about 20 years now, but it gets more and more refined, and our ability to target the cancer constantly improves, which decreases the side effects. And this is a very commonly used treatment for early stage lung cancer, and it's been incredibly successful with very high cure rates using radiation. There are also situations where the tumor has spread to the lymph nodes, and this is what we call locally advanced lung cancer. So it hasn't spread outside of the lung, but it's still within the chest cavity, but in the lung and the lymph nodes that drain from the lung. And this we have to take a more aggressive approach, and typically people are treated with radiation and with chemotherapy at the same time. And because a bigger area of the body is getting irradiated and more sensitive structures like the breathing tubes and it's near the food pipe, the esophagus, we have to do the treatment slower. So it can't be done in just four treatments, but usually it's about 30 treatments. So that's one treatment a day, Monday through Friday, for about 6 weeks. And this does an excellent job of curing these tumors as well. So the standard of care, if a locally advanced lung cancer can't be cut out, can't have surgery, is to do radiation therapy and chemotherapy, and then follow it with some of the immunotherapy that's been talked about earlier in this program. And again, that's a very highly successful way of treating it. We have it's very high cure rates with this, and the success rate of this treatment continues to improve over time. And lastly, as we know, lung tumors can spread outside of the lung, and sometimes that can cause symptoms. So, for example, if the tumor is invading the bone, that can be very painful and cause bone pain, and there can be a high risk of fractures if it's a bone that bears the weight, such as the femur, the thigh bone. So we frequently give radiation in a palliative setting to improve pain in this area. We're not trying to eradicate all the disease. What we're trying to do is take care of this particular symptom, for example, bone pain or a tumor pressing on the breathing tubes, and alleviate that symptom so people feel better. And these situations, as discussed earlier, chemotherapy and other systemic therapies and immunotherapy is going to be the standard of care, but radiation is extremely effective for helping with this one particular problem. So really, radiation therapy and radiation oncologists play a role pretty much for all patients who have lung cancer, regardless of their stage, and just figure out when the right time is to involve the radiation oncologist. And thank you very much for the opportunity to talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rosenzweig. That was so comprehensive, and you really identified the different ways in which the radiation oncologist plays a role in the treatment itself, the radiation treatment and managing non-small cell lung cancer and cancer pain. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Chirag Kapadia. Dr. Kapadia is fellow, Department of Hematology, Medical Oncology, Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, University of Arizona. And Dr. Kapadia will be addressing the important role of lifestyle, movement, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now and to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kapadia.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Kapadia here. Thank you so much for this speaking opportunity and hoping everyone's day is going well. And thanks to the previous presenters as well with awesome topics. So I'm going to be talking about the importance of lifestyle, movement, and quality of life in non-small cell lung cancer. You know, something that actually will touch all stages of your treatment, pre-treatment, as well as in the survivorship realm. And so what we want to do is think about how can we support our patients throughout this strenuous journey during treatment, as well as how can we continue to support our patients after their treatment is completed. And so speaking about lifestyle, just to begin with, physical activity, nutrition, both of which influence inflammation, immune regulation, as well as treatment tolerance and fatigue. We've noted that weight loss, muscle loss correlate with worse outcomes overall and treatment toxicities. And so an aspect really that an integrative oncologist will discuss with patients is looking at multiple kind of facets of a patient's lifestyle. What are your physical activity, daily things that you're doing? What is your nutrition look like? What does your appetite look like? And how can we help bolster those ideas? For example, if patients are already going to the gym, how can we continue to do what you're doing with your workouts at that time? But also for other patients who may not have been so regular with physical activity, how do we start to make small goals that are achievable that we're able to really motivate our patients? For example, even walking 10 minutes after each meal just to help, you know, get some activity throughout your day, 30 minutes total. And so just how can we even include small snippets of ways to really improve one's overall lifestyle, right? And in hopefully secondary effect, this will also improve patients' mental health and mental well-being. Oftentimes patients and loved ones can become quite depressed or anxious with their treatments and different toxicities. And how do we combat that? And so physical activity and movement can really help with those types of ideas. But additionally, one small thing that you can do is considering even breathing exercises to help regulate kind of that nervous system and that emotional response and kind of take you from an anxiety state into one where you can look through a different perspective, hopefully without the anxiety, for example. And quick things that you can do just while you're even sitting at home, not things that you need to go and particularly kind of search out or seek out. Other things that we like to focus on is nutrition, as I spoke about. How do we preserve your body mass, your muscle mass? How do we get an adequate amount of protein in? And how do we feed your body with healthy foods that are not processed, but will also give your body the energy it needs to really fight through the cancer, as well as give you energy through the treatments. And then looking about after you're done with your cancer, you're still a full person. How do we really improve your diet to keep it as healthy as possible so we reduce other risks, such as cardiovascular risk, for example? And then finally, all of these items hopefully correlate into a quality of life improvement. If we can help improve small strides in terms of anxiety and depression, can we help improve the overall quality of life of our patient from a physical, emotional, social, and spiritual standpoint? And by doing this, we're able to address function, meaning, resilience throughout the diagnosis, treatment, and in the survivorship realm. And so it's a really interesting and unique experience that we have as integrative oncologists, getting to speak with our patients and learning so much more in depth about what makes them, what makes them a person, and how can we keep these things at the forefront of our mind and our treatment paradigms, right? Because as our patients go through treatment, we want to focus and remember that our patients are living through treatment, and how can we improve the quality of life, and how can we make it as tolerable and hopefully enjoyable as possible. And so our goal is, of course, to get as many days of life as we can, but also can we get more life into each day. Thank you so much, everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. That was beautifully spoken, very poignant, and I think probably resonates for many of our participants on the call, things that they can do on a regular basis that really would enhance their lives. So thank you so much. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Diana Baird, and Ms. Baird is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and recommendations. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in your tolerance to treatment and providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Your diet might be modified during and or after your cancer treatment just to assist with managing some of the side effects to help you meet your nutrition goals. Some potential side effects you may experience might include things like dry mouth, difficulty swallowing, changes in taste, a decreased appetite, maybe some indigestion or reflux, and fatigue. During your course of treatment, your nutrition needs can increase. This may require a change in your diet or changing up some of the foods that you're currently consuming. If you're not able to meet your nutrition needs, it can impact your overall health and your tolerance to treatment. It can even delay your treatment. So the role of the dietitian is to help support you in finding ways and encouraging and modifying your diet so that you can meet your calorie, protein, and fluid goals. A dietitian is part of the healthcare team, and so knowing how to reach out to the dietitian is very important. I always encourage patients to connect with the dietitian early on in their journey. That way they can have a relationship from the beginning, get some questions and concerns answered, and then as things go on throughout their treatment, they have that relationship established. Oftentimes with lung cancer, patients get fatigued, and this is a big challenge that can happen, but it is, we can work through it. We can absolutely find ways to make it work. And with the fatigue, oftentimes the patient feels full very quickly. So some suggestions might be small frequent meals, focusing on those high-calorie, high-protein foods, setting a timer to remind you to eat and not overeating at each meal. Even if you're overweight, you can become malnourished. So it's very important that you know your healthcare team, you know your nutrition goals, and you're connected with your dietitian so you know how to address those issues early on. Hydration is something that we often don't talk a lot about, but when you're not eating a lot, you're typically not drinking a lot. There can be some side effects that come with dehydration, such as nausea, fatigue. It can even make you feel dizzy. So flu is anything that's liquid at room temperature, water, juice, milk. A general guideline most people need is between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. Some treatments, such as radiation, may require adjustments in fluid needs, or some other comorbidities that you may already have may require some adjustments. So talk with your healthcare team about those. In closing, a dietitian is part of your healthcare team. We're here to support you throughout your journey. And know that nutrition is a big part of your treatment plan, and know how to reach us so that we can help support you sooner rather than later. I'm going to close now and hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a superb presentation. Lots of wonderful information for our participants, and to be sure you have adequate nutrition and hydration. That's so important. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Anfish Stegall, and Ms. Stegall is a nurse. She's Senior Vice President, Patient Services and Health Care Delivery, Longevity Foundation, and she'll be addressing Longevity Foundation's free programs and services and Longevity Cancer Helpline, and also their website. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Anfish Stegall.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. And at Longevity Foundation, which is a global lung cancer advocacy foundation, we are so proud to partner with Cancer Care for these educational webinars. Longevity is dedicated to research, support, and early detection. We fund young investigators. We support clinical research. We have many precision medicine initiatives. And then we do a lot with patients as well. We have virtual meetups, which are virtual support groups, which are very community building and very well attended. We have peer-to-peer mentoring. We have multiple Facebook communities and other social media groups. We have a special group for small cell lung cancer patients called the Small Cell Lung Cancer Smashers. We do one-on-one navigation with social workers and oncology nurses. We also have a helpline that you can speak directly to someone and ask questions and be forwarded to whatever service that you might need. I'll give that number quickly, and then it's also on our website. It's 833-797-5800. Our website, which is longevity.org, has multiple educational materials. It has gateways that help you navigate whatever subtype of lung cancer you have. There's also an area where your physicians can order free materials, and we also are very engaged in community outreach with your healthcare providers and are very dedicated to equality and access to care. We also have several live events coming up in November, which is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. We have several Breathe Deep Together fundraising races and walks across the country, virtual lunch and learns, and then the first weekend in May, which is May 1st through the 3rd, we will cap off our crown jewel of our patient, survivor, and and Caregiver Events, which is called Hope Summit. And this year it will be held May 1st through the 3rd in Dallas, Texas. So in a nutshell, please visit our website at longevity.org and find many resources that can help you with lung cancer. And I'll hand it back to Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fitzgerald. That was a wonderful presentation. It certainly is a go-to organization for anyone with lung cancer. We partner with them for many, many years now, and it's a wonderful resource. So please do take advantage of all that they have to offer. And I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. I'm Senior Director of Education and Training with Cancer Care, and I'm going to be discussing our Cancer Care's free national programs and services, our Hope Line, and our website. So you might wonder what exactly do we do at Cancer Care. So we offer practical and financial assistance, help with food insecurity. We do offer online support groups for every type of cancer, including lung cancer, in terms of small cell lung cancer. And we also have a Hope Line, which you can contact at 800-813-4673, which is staffed by our social work department, and they will pick up the phone when you call, and they will connect you to what your needs might be. We also have coping circles, which are support groups for people. And we also have a number of community education workshops like this one on many different types of cancer and different topics. So that in a thumbnail sketch gives you an idea of the programs that we offer. And now we go back to our Q&A. We'll be bringing up all of our speakers. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to our participants how to pose their online questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. Sabari. After a mass is found on a chest X-ray, what is the next step? How do doctors decide which method to use when confirming diagnosis?
Yes, this is a really important question. And, you know, first off, I usually mention that, you know, all you need is lungs to develop lung cancer. You know, we see lung cancer in people who've smoked. We see lung cancer in people who've never smoked. And also we see people who are asymptomatic, who have a chest X-ray and identified to have a mass or a lesion in the lung. Usually the next step is to really get a history to understand that patient's risk, but then to get further imaging. So I generally start with a CT scan of the chest to better evaluate that lesion, that mass in the lung. We then oftentimes will follow up with a PET CT, a PET scan, to help us understand if there's any other disease outside of the chest. And it's really important because the biopsy will be guided by the most distant area of disease. Because what we'll do is we'll make a diagnosis and we'll also prove the stage based upon that. And there's two real ways that we can get a biopsy. We can do it by interventional radiology, and that's usually image-guided, either ultrasound for the liver, for example, or, you know, a CT-guided for a lung lesion. We can also do a bronchoscopy, which is more of an invasive procedure where a camera is put into the airway, and by using ultrasound technology, we can biopsy through the airway into the lung or into the lymph nodes in the middle part of the chest.
Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Bria. What are the most common metastatic sites for patients with non-small cell lung cancer? How likely is the cancer to be metastatic at the time of diagnosis?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a good question. I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of our patients do present with metastatic lung cancer. You know, we didn't talk a lot, but there are, you know, patients that we do recommend screening for, you know, based on, you know, if they had a history of smoking, and some patients, you know, incidentally have lung nodules that are followed up. You know, but we do see, you know, unfortunately, the majority of patients we do meet with lung cancer have, you know, either advanced stage 3 or stage 4 lung cancer. And so, you know, the discussion is, you know, what do we do in the case of stage 4? Often we talk about, you know, therapy that's palliative, meaning, you know, the goal of the treatment is to help you feel better and live longer. And, you know, we have seen really dramatic advances with, you know, in some cases where, you know, these therapies can be very, very effective for many, many years. But again, you know, a lot of the biomarker testing that I had mentioned helps us to really pinpoint, you know, what's the best therapy for the patient in the beginning. And, you know, often if that treatment doesn't work or it works well and it stops working, you know, then we either think about clinical trials or, you know, other lines of therapy. But, you know, I would say, you know, a lot of our patients that we are meeting, you know, we present with, you know, what we would say stage 4 disease. And, you know, in terms of places that lung cancer often spreads too early, you know, we often see lung cancer either spreading to other parts of the lung. You know, it frequently goes to the bone, an area in the body called the adrenal glands, and it can also spread to the brain. And, you know, as Dr. Sarai had mentioned, you know, we often recommend when we meet patients that have a diagnosis of lung cancer imaging, either with CAT scans or PET scans, as well as an MRI of the brain, just because the, you know, way the PET scan works doesn't give us, or the CAT scan doesn't give us good imaging of the brain. So, you know, you may hear your oncologist recommend, you know, these sets of imaging, and that's why, because we really want to get a good baseline picture to really assess where the cancer is. In some cases, you know, we also think about involving, you know, we had a great conversation about the role of radiation, you know, in some cases surgery. You know, that's one thing with lung cancer, it's a very multidisciplinary approach to how we treat patients. But I hope that gets to the question.
Thank you so much. And the question for Dr. Rosenzweig, what are the treatment options for someone with stage 3A non-small cell lung cancer that cannot be removed with surgery?
Yes, thank you. So this is what I was discussing a little bit before, which stage 3A is also called locally advanced disease. So this is cancer that's in the lung and in the lymph nodes. And surgery is certainly an option in this case, combined with chemotherapy these days, typically before the surgery, or it could also be done after the surgery, or chemotherapy and immunotherapy, I should more accurately say. But as I mentioned earlier, there are some situations where surgery is not an option just because surgery can have a lot of side effects, and someone might not be able to tolerate a major surgery like this would be, or it could be the tumor is just not in a good place to be cut out. It might just be in a bad location. So in these situations, we do chemotherapy and radiation combined, and then afterwards we typically immunotherapy or targeted therapy is recommended, depending on what the tumor looks like when a detailed analysis is done. So radiation is definitely a mainstay of treatment for stage 3A lung cancer or locally advanced lung cancer, and it is a very commonly used treatment in that situation.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Ricciuti, is there a comprehensive online source for advice for managing side effects?
It's a good question, and especially for new class of therapeutics, including those that have new side effects that are not side effects we are traditionally used to see in patients. For example, those we see with, you know, traditional chemotherapies or, you know, some targeted therapies that we've been using for years. There are now online resources, and I have to say that companies specifically have been producing material for patients and their families they can review. And actually, in some clinics, including ours, we have pamphlets that we can hand to patients who are embarking on a new treatment with some of these medications, specifically for patients who have small cell lung cancer, for example, starting on tarlatamab, or patients with EGFR mutations starting on amivantamab, whether that is in combination with chemotherapies for a specific EGFR mutation, or if it's combined with targeted therapies. We do have online resources, and patients, if they look and go on each of these company websites, they have material that can be downloaded in lay language that helps understand what are the most common side effects, but more importantly, how to handle these side effects. In addition to online resources, which can be found also at a specific nonprofit organization websites is also a helpful, and I think that's something we have implemented, at least in our clinic, to provide patients with teaching sheets, material that when patients start the therapy are handed over to them and their family, where we highlight what are the most common side effects from these therapies, what to expect in the subsequent days, and also how to handle potentially these side effects that may arise over time, when to call your oncology team, which symptoms to watch out for. And so I think all these resources are certainly very, very important for patients. As for the online material, I think there are multiple ways where to look. Each of the patient advocacy groups, for example, the EGFR resistor, for example, the KRAS kickers, there are multiple advocacy groups that have now on the website material that can be downloaded also forum where they can share their experience. And oftentimes, and I was surprised to see that, but it's very interesting to learn that there are community and forums where patients share their experience, and sometimes they share alternative methods that are helping them improving tolerance to treatments, something that even their provider have not thought about. Certainly that's also a very helpful resource to help managing these symptoms.
Also, could you just address this question from a patient? I am currently undergoing chemotherapy. Can I still join a clinical trial? Could you comment on that as well?
Yes. Clinical trials, of course, is something we do encourage to participate in, as these provide new options for patients that are not yet FDA approved. I will say that some of the criteria to enroll into clinical trial is that the treatment, the most recent treatment the patient was on has stopped working. And so for patients who have been experiencing a disease growth or a growth of their cancer during that treatment, that's a good juncture to participate into clinical trials. Usually for patients who are on a chemotherapy specifically, we do recommend to continue on the therapy as long as treatment is effective and as long as it's safe. If one of these two conditions lacks, and for example, the tumors start to grow again, or the tolerability and the safety profile are prohibitive for the patient, that is also a good juncture to start on a clinical trial. I will mention that there are clinical trials where patients are enrolled in the maintenance phase of their therapies. So there are scenarios where patients are on chemotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy combination, for example, for small cell lung cancer. And then if the tumor is responding, then there is an option to start a maintenance therapy with, investigational agent. So I think the answer is, in general, we don't recommend trials for patients that are on chemotherapy unless the trial is exploring a medicine that can be added to chemotherapy as maintenance therapy. So I guess it depends on the specific clinical scenario.
And a question for Dr. Sabari. How does treatment change when both non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer properties are found and the cancer is stage 4? Are there new options? Oh, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a really important question. You know, particularly for patients with EGFR mutation positive lung cancer, but also other driver mutations, that's a non-small cell lung cancer, generally an adenocarcinoma. And after treatment with targeted therapies, so for example, osimertinib, one of the third generation EGFR inhibitors, 10 to 15% of patients can develop what we call histologic transformation, where the tumor actually changes and looks biologically different. You know, these are very tough to treat cancers, and we generally recommend treating the small cell component. It's controversial whether to continue the EGFR inhibition or not. I generally do, depending on the clinical scenario. There are novel therapies in the small cell lung cancer space that we heard about, particularly BiTEs, bispecific T-cell engagers, that are starting to be looked at in this patient population. But I do caution patients that the biology for EGFR mutation lung cancer that transforms to small cell is different than someone who's newly diagnosed with small cell lung cancer up front.
Okay, thank you. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Sabari. Just a quick takeaway from the program today.
I think the key takeaway is not to lose hope. I think this is a disease that is common. It's a disease that we're learning more and more about. And we now understand a lot about the biology of this cancer. And remember, all you need to do is have lungs to develop lung cancer. So we need to remove that stigma. We need to, you know, sort of make sure that everyone has, you know, efficient and sort of rapid biomarker testing so that people can be matched to the best therapy. And we heard a lot today about clinical trials. I do think that is the future. So ask your team, ask your clinical, you know, sort of focus group about what clinical trials are available to me. If not now, what down the road may be available to me in the future.
Excellent. And Dr. Elliot Josephria, your takeaway?
Yeah, I completely agree with, you know, everything that's been said before. And, you know, I really think that, you know, the future is very bright. I think we're getting a lot of new treatments. I've been amazed, you know, we've had a lot of recent major oncology conferences to show new developments and new treatments. And, you know, this is a global community, you know, as Dr. Savari mentioned, you know, lung cancer, we see this everywhere. This is one of the most common cancers in the world, but, you know, fortunately there's a lot of research being done across the world, and, you know, I think we're adapting and trying to push these drugs so that either, you know, if not in the clinical trial, getting them approved and out to patients more rapidly. And so, you know, I do think, you know, for the patients on the line and their family members, there's a lot of hope and a lot of dedication, you know, including a lot of people on the line here to really continue to push the envelope and come up with new treatments that not only work better, but are, you know, much better tolerated so that patients can go on and, you know, live a lifestyle that they were, you know, able to travel and go see family, you know, work or, you know, go do events that, you know, really they enjoy. And I've been able to see, you know, a lot of my patients been able to achieve those life goals still while, you know, getting treatment for lung cancer. So.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Ricucci.
Yes, and I think I agree with Dr. Savoy and Dr. Brea. I think new therapies means new toxicity for sure, but it also means new hope. And with all the new therapeutics that are being developed, some of which we reviewed today, next-generation immunotherapy, antibody-drug conjugates, we're dealing with new side effects, and I think for us the most important thing is to be proactive. Prevention works. We've learned that in many different settings. And something that's important that sometimes causes, I think, stress to patients is holding or reduce the dose. It doesn't mean treatment failure. It's a strategy to actually protect patients, maintain quality of life, and actually allow patients to ultimately continue therapy. And I'd like everyone to be aware about this concept, because I know how being on a treatment hold, for example, can cause, of course, stress and anxiety in patients, but that's actually a measure that will ultimately help them resume their care.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Rosenzweig.
Thank you. So I've been specializing in the treatment of lung cancer for almost 30 years. And looking back, I can tell you that there's not a thing that we had done 30 years ago that we still do the same today, because we're constantly improving, constantly making things safer for patients and more effective. So I think we're still going to see advances like this in the years to come, and it's always very exciting to see the improvements that come across all therapies, surgery, medical oncology, radiation oncology, pulmonology. All these fields are improving rapidly, and it's really just going to get better outcomes for all the people that we treat. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Kapadia.
Thank you, everyone. This was a great experience to be a part of. Hopefully, my takeaway point for patients is that, you know, you're a whole person, but cancer is a part of you. However, there are more parts of you that make you you. And so it's time to look at just everything alongside that. So we want to look at the whole person. We want to look at all the other parts and see how can we really treat and nourish the other parts of you while you undergo this extensive treatment portion or even the survivorship realm. So really, how can we keep you as a patient and all the different parts of you at the forefront of what we're doing? Thank you, everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. That's lovely. Thank you. And Ms. Fischigal.
Yes, I agree with everything that has been said. This was a wonderful presentation, and I hope that all of you see just how much progress has been made in recent years. And as Dr. Savari said, never to give up hope and to also know that you are not in this alone. There are many resources for education, support, finances,
clinical trials, so many resources available to you that we don't ever want you to feel like you are on this journey alone. So please reach out to Longevity Foundation, to the other advocacy foundations that were mentioned to you. There's always so much support to help you travel this road and not be alone. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Yeah, thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been phenomenal. And although we've done this program before, I have to say that this program has been the best ever. Both the questions have been fantastic, and the speakers are, of course, fantastic. So the connection of the two has made this really a super program. It's just been phenomenal. I do want to mention a few things. Basically, Longevity Foundation will be sending out a SurveyMonkey evaluation about 10 days after the program, and that will include all the resources we mentioned during the program. So you'll get all the websites, all the telephone numbers, any resources that we gave out. You'll be getting that. You'll get that information. We've learned from many of you over the time of doing these programs that many of you have difficulty reaching your healthcare team evenings, weekends, and holidays. So please always, you can reach people during the day, usually your healthcare team, but usually evenings, weekends, and holidays are very complicated to reach someone. So always check with your healthcare team who you can reach evenings, weekends, and holidays. Those seem to be the times when people do have questions or concerns that come up, and so it's very important that you have that information. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I think, again, as has been said before, you are not alone. We are all here to help you, and please take advantage of all the resources that we've been mentioning during the program. Thank you, and have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.